Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Totally Football Show. Today, Liverpool host Southampton and Jeremy Corbyn at Anfield for a match featuring loads of rampant reds, a controversial switch in the number 10 role, and completely ineffective opposition. Corbyn. Nope, got nothing. Anyway, we round up that game and all the rest of the weekend's action and have a big look forward to the Carabao Cup and more, plus news from Europe in this Totally Football Show. Yep, special Chas Hodges tribute edition this week. Totally Football Show with Rabbit, if you will. Provided by a very special lineup. It's a Happy New Year to Raphael Honigstein.
Thank you.
Who joins us from the year 5779.
That's correct.
All right. How's it going for you so far, Raph?
It's been good so far, yes.
Great, okay. Yeah. Excellent. Michael Cox also here.
Hi, James.
And Michael, you and I have a hot date tonight.
Yeah, with other people involved in watching, which is peculiar, but looking forward to it.
It's all right, listeners. He's only talking about Totally Football Show live at the South Bank Centre.
The premier event tonight at the South Bank Centre.
Why? Are there others?
It's the FIFA Best Awards, I believe.
Okay. All right. Adam Bate, a.k.a. Ghost Goal, joins us hot from Wolverhampton.
Sort of. London.
Okay. From London. Do you live in London, Adam?
I live sometime in London, sometime Wolverhampton.
Okay.
Splitting my time between the two.
All right.
Major metropolis of the
You
country.
Were Old Trafford on Saturday, that much I know.
Yes. Big six-pointer that was drawn.
Yeah. There ain't no pleasing moo to, you know, continue our Chas and Dave theme. And also joining us on a Totally Football Show debut is Melissa Reddy, senior football correspondent from Joe, and of course a prized contributor for all sorts of noted podcasts, entities such as the Anfield
Wrap,
Five Live things and that anyway. But you went to Anfield this weekend.
Yeah, a really weird one. Liverpool changed their shape. They decided to go 4-2-3-1, which they haven't done before. And it was more interesting because they actually didn't have a chance to work on the shape in training because of the weather conditions. And you could tell, actually, because they were very open. They struggled without their third midfielder, and then Shaqiri had a free role. But I think it actually worked for them in a sense that against a Southampton side that were determined to not give them any space and to basically, you know, set up a blockade at Anfield, that extra attacker meant that Liverpool could go 3-0 up and then just control the game. Southampton didn't ever have, even though Liverpool were open, too open in the first half by Jurgen Klopp standards, Southampton didn't have enough to hurt them.
So that whole first half formation was entirely due to the adverse wind conditions?
No, he wanted to play that shape because they knew Southampton were going to be obstructive, but they didn't get a chance to work on it. And
right.
You could tell that everyone wasn't really comfortable with the shape. It took Southampton by surprise. They just couldn't deal with having another. I mean, when you've got Mane, Firmino and Salah to worry about, that's enough of a headache. And then you've got Shaqiri roaming all over the place. And he's so unpredictable. And yeah, 45 minutes, that was game over. When Shaqiri got taken off, which was, you know, he contributed two goals and got pulled, it seemed like the life of the game followed him as well. It wasn't fun anymore after that, but Liverpool are serious now, and I think that substitution and the way they control the game in the second half prove that.
All right. How long have you been watching Liverpool for, Melissa?
Since I was 6 years old.
All right, I don't know how long that is, but let me ask you, is this the best Liverpool you've ever seen?
It is the most complete Liverpool side I've watched. I think 2008, 2009 had a really strong spine, but you always looked at Liverpool and felt there was just something missing, one thing. And I think at the moment, you don't get that sense. It's a really good goalkeeper, one of the best centre-backs in Europe, the most explosive forward line on the continent, steel in midfield, greater depth, and a really charismatic manager.
Melissa, do you get the sense that teams of the calibre of Southampton now start going to Liverpool almost fearing result, that it's almost a foregone conclusion that they were not going to get anything from this game?
Yeah, I think Mark Hughes' post-match comments were quite instructive, because he said at 3-0, we were just thinking damage limitation. And the way he set his team up to obstruct rather than to provide any sort of threat of their own, I think, because, you know, without Danny Ings, who's been so good for them this season, I think they knew they lacked bite up front. So from the start of the game, it was, let's not concede too many. And once the three happened, it was like, whoa, let's not concede anymore. And he touched on that after the game and said, you know, teams will come here and will get a lot worse done to them this season. So we're content with basically drawing the second half.
Right. Mark Hughes in content shock. What did you make of the remarkable hooking of Shaqiri after he contributed assists for two goals, Michael? Was it okay because it was for Milner, who everyone loves?
Yeah, I really like that, actually, because it was just Klopp saying, you know, the game is won, let's shut down the game, and nothing really happened second half, did it? And I think that's, I mean, my concern about Liverpool in terms of winning the title is still in terms of whether they're going to have the energy to play that way throughout the season. So if you only need to play half the game, that's fantastic. Mm. Remind me a little bit of Arsenal under Wenger when they were winning titles. They'd win the game in 20 minutes and the, you know, the next 70 were just energy conservation. I think it's interesting what Melissa says about this being the best team since 2008, 2009, because I think Liverpool have been a little bit unfortunate in the sense that those two teams have been up against really, really good sides. Yeah. The United side, who just won the treble, probably got better the next year. City have just won 100 points. Maybe they've got better this season. I mean, I think this Liverpool team or that previous Liverpool team probably would have won the title six or seven times in the kind of 9 years between those. You look at that Manchester United team, the last one under Ferguson. Even the two City teams, I don't think, were all-time great sides, whereas this Liverpool side is really, really a serious contender.
Right, OK. Of course, Shaqiri lucky to get 45 minutes. If you look at it from Fabinho's point of view, when's he actually going to have a look in, do you think, Melissa?
Well, Wednesday's a great opportunity against Chelsea. He's only played a minute so far, so yeah, Shaqiri can count himself lucky. But I think he just needs to get up to speed with the system. It's so taxing and demanding, and I think what we've seen from the games in the Premier League already this season is if you switch off for 5-10 minutes, or if you're not at 100%, you know, for even the shortest spell in a game, you can get punished. Chelsea against West Ham was an example of Chelsea just not being intense enough to force an opening, started playing out of desperation. And if you're bringing a new player into such a competitive environment when your ambitions are at the absolute highest, it is a risk. So I think easing him in, as Andy Robertson and Oxlade-Chamberlain were last season, is the smart decision.
We'll talk about Chelsea's performance at the London Stadium in a second. But Melissa, do you have an update on Virgil van Dijk's health as Liverpool approach this very arduous month?
Yeah, he damaged or got a bruise to his ribs before the PSG game and took another knock to it against Southampton, so it's nothing serious. He was never going to play on Wednesday, so a little bit of rest for him, and I think he should be fine for the weekend.
All right. Wednesday, when they take on Chelsea, the first of two encounters in the space of a week, a Chelsea team fresh from their first goalless game under Maurizio Sarri. Did you see this game, Adam?
I did, yes. It was West Ham had the better chances and could have won it. I think it was a game that showed some of the flaws in this Chelsea team that kind of, they've hinted at them in the first few games, but they've won all the games, obviously, up till now. Jorginho played the record amount of passes in the Premier League game, more than twice as many as anyone else on the pitch, which I think is unusual.
So he attempted 180 passes, which works out to one every 30 seconds.
Yep.
Now, is that not an entirely positive thing? It basically means that everything's going through him, doesn't it?
It was really striking that happened because nobody else made 100 passes, so it was almost like everything had to go to him and then out to someone else, which So you get people talked of as playmakers these days, but they're often not particularly playmakers. The ball just comes to them, they create more than other players. Whereas this was actually Jorginho, everything had to go through him. And I think Gary Neville said on commentary that he actually passed the ball poorly. And
Well, he gave it
strange
away a fair amount,
I mean, maybe that's just because he had it so much. And I think that's a concern, that they're so reliant on him that he's going to have games where he can't unlock it.
Mm.
A few other things. I thought Kante, everyone's been intrigued by seeing him further up the field. And this was probably that game where the chances fell to him. And he's not that player. He's not going to score 15 goals from midfield. And also Hazard, I thought, was obviously the best player. He's probably my favourite player in the Premier League. But you sort of looked at him, does he want to score goals quite as much as other players? There were a couple of flicks he attempted when he was clean through. And yeah, it was just one of those games where you feel like 2 points dropped, but Yarmolenko had the best chance of the game.
Absolutely. And West Ham deserve credit for their shape, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, part of their plan was to let Jorginho have the ball. I think that was very obvious. Antonio was up front, but wasn't dropping back onto him. He was staying as a counter-attacking threat. I mean, I think that is the kind of crucial storyline and the crucial debate at the moment. A lot of Chelsea fans are quite confused at why Kante, having played so well in that deep position, has been moved higher up the pitch. Personally, I think a potential solution is Kante actually dropping out the team altogether. And they've got Fabregas to come back. Fabregas, Jorginho and Kovacic is an incredibly creative midfield.
Yeah.
I can't really see the argument for putting Kante in the deep position, I've got to say. I mean, he's so good defensively. He was excellent for a Leicester side and a Chelsea side that played very defensively and counter-attacking. But if you're going to have all the possession, as Chelsea are this season, you're better off having Jorginho in that role. So
too far up the field to actually make a difference and stop in the counter-attacks
I just think Kante finds himself under one of the worst managers he could be playing under, really.
Well, Maurizio Sarri made the point contrasting his development with Chelsea to that of Liverpool under Klopp. And I think it's a fair one, I think, to change so dramatically from Conte's football to Sarri ball is always going to take time. Is always going to throw out one or two unconvincing performances, especially after a Europa League excursion to far-flung lands with uncertain departure slots. So,
Greece?
Yes.
Yeah.
Their plane was delayed, so they only got back very, very late.
Oh, did they?
On Friday, yeah.
All right.
So I wouldn't worry so much. I think, if anything, I think they're slightly ahead of schedule, conversely, as a team, and play better than I expected them. I thought they may be a little bit disjointed because it's so difficult to play possession football and pressing and do both really well. Usually one of the two suffers immediately, as we've seen with Liverpool for a number of years almost before they got it right completely.
Right. Rafa, Jurgen Klopp's record in terms of silverware at Liverpool needs improving.
Yes.
Will he be committing a full-strength team, Virgil van Dijk apart, for this midweek Carabao Cup clash?
I doubt it very much that it'll be a full-strength team. There would have been changes anyway, even if this had been sort of a run-of-the-mill Premier League game. And I think the squad now is big enough to make changes, at least two or three a game, without necessarily anyone saying, you know, he's weakening the starting 11. Jordan Henderson will be out, Milner will be out, Wijnaldum might be out. So midfield offers you possibilities for rotation. And up front, you've got four, maybe five players for three positions, if you count Sturridge as well. So I think it'll be maybe not the B team, but one or two more of the sort of Shaqiri Sturridge type players will come in, I'm sure.
Mm, exciting. OK, well, after this, let's talk about events at Old Trafford as Man United hosted Wolves.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Man United won, Wolves won. Nobody won, Adam. You were there.
I was, yeah.
James Render says, did United really compete or do they need to show they were hungry like the Wolves? Nice, James.
That's
Render.
What Mourinho said. He was not impressed with the attitude at all, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know if he was making a Duran Duran reference. Like
no, he
James
didn't, he didn't
was.
Go that far. But no. Yeah, I thought Wolves had more shots on target. I thought they were more than held their own. And the problems at United, I mean, they'd won three games in a row going into this one, but I think the problems are still obvious. And it's not just, it was actually the attack that was the issue against Wolves. So all the stuff about would Alderweireld and Maguire make the difference, I think the result would have been very similar because they just didn't have any pattern of play in the attacking third.
Right. Wolves, by contrast, looked really composed and kept it. I mean, I thought they looked really impressive, very simple, but very direct. And you know, we're perhaps unfortunate not to get more out of the game. You were boldly predicting a top eight finish last time you were in. Would you care to revise that now?
No, I don't think so. It's gone better than probably some of the fans expected. I think a lot of people have been impressed by Neves and Moutinho and the way they... It's quite an exciting team in some of the players they've got, but it's actually the control that's striking with Wolves. They've conceded the fewest clear-cut chances apart from Liverpool this season. They've conceded two in the last four. And they kind of, everyone knows their job in that team, and they always keep at least five players behind the ball. So while I think they look exciting, perhaps on highlights, they actually can control the game without the ball, and that's probably the big thing for them.
Very nice.
I wonder if there's a point where Jose will feel he has to adjust his tactics to perhaps a slightly different Premier League to how it used to be when he won it. Certainly when he won it first time out with Chelsea, I think the idea that you can just sit back and wait for teams to kind of fall apart and their chaotic attempts to chase an equaliser or a winner is no longer so fruitful, because you have teams that can play real football and will enjoy actually having the ball in midfield and will be very careful with it and will open you up, especially if your individual players at the back are not that amazing to go up against these 1v1 challenges. Mm. Pogba obviously made the point. You wonder how much of that is politics and how much he actually believes in it when he criticises United's failure to attack and failure to press. It's probably a mixture of both. But it is certainly a way of playing that doesn't seem to suit anymore.
I thought Pogba was actually one of their better players, and it was a lovely cushion pass for Fred's goal. But I think Sanchez is an issue. He doesn't seem to have any combination play with the fullback.
Everyone piling on to Sanchez, highest paid player in British football history, and significantly when Mourinho went chasing a goal after Wolves had equalised, he took him off.
Yeah, having not played him in midweek, so surely that wasn't the plan.
Right.
He doesn't seem to have any relationship with Lukaku either, which I think is important. I know he set up a goal for him against Burnley, but Lukaku just couldn't get into the game, even though he was up against a...
No shots from the big Belgian. Dan Talentire says, Moura came to Spurs in January and looks to have benefited now because of it. Alexis did the same to United and he somehow looks worse. And Thomas, meanwhile, asking, Sanchez, wrong manager, wrong formation, or just past his best? What do you think?
I think a bit of all of those.
Right.
I think there was a suggestion the last season at Arsenal, when his form dipped a little bit, that it was just because he was unhappy. Now you look at it and he looks a completely different player from the one who scored 30 goals for Arsenal his last full season there. And I just wonder whether we're ever going to see him be that player that they want him to be.
Yikes.
Yeah, just on Pogba, if I can go back to him.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have anything to say about Sanchez other than what Adam said. I thought it summed him up because he played very well, as Adam says, and his touch for Fred's goal was fantastic. But
his touch for the Mourinho goal was pretty useful.
It was so frustrating because there was just no need to do that in that situation. It was such an obvious thing where he had a backwards pass to the centre-back, keep possession going. And it wasn't just the fact he lost the ball. It was quite pathetic, I thought, the way he lost the ball.
And I think that's the sort of thing that frustrates Mourinho, because he even said in the press conference that he'd warned the players about Neves and Moutinho nicking the ball in midfield. And that's how they got their goal against West Ham the previous week. So things where the manager specifically told them that's the problem to avoid and that they concede.
It felt like a clash, or a clash of contrasts, I would say, because like you pointed out, Wolves knew exactly what they needed to do in possession and out of it, were very aggressive, quite assertive. And United were waddling through the game often without any sort of coherent approach or strategy. And, you know, as much as you can continuously fault the players, which Mourinho has done, I think everything we've discussed goes back to the point that this is not Manchester United anymore. It doesn't feel like Manchester United, doesn't play like Manchester United. Nothing about it screams that. And the fact that a Wolves side can go there, you know, with their backs out, chest out, just shows that they don't have that fear factor anymore, and that's dangerous.
What was the mood like at Old Trafford?
It was okay. There was groans when Sanchez knocked the ball out of play from that free kick towards the back end of the first half. There wasn't any screams of attack, 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 and that sort of thing. They were pushing, doing all the pushing in the last 20 minutes.
Even Sir Alex was keeping his cool, was he?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think what Melissa says about kind of the approach to the game, there's talk about Fellaini being the plan B, but he had the best chance of the game. He's almost the plan A. I don't know what plan A is at United at the moment.
All right. OK. Can we talk about Adama Traore?
Always.
Always. Okay, so no one had more attempts on goal than him, and he came on in the 75th minute. It's a bit like that stat the other day where he had the most successful dribbles in the Premier League, despite the fact that he'd been in about 90 minutes of action.
His previous two appearances, he'd had the most dribbles after coming on.
Right.
He had three chances in stoppage time in this game. I think he's pushing for a start, but I don't think Nuno wants to change the team. He's played the same team all six games, and he likes to be able to introduce him late on against tiring legs.
Is he a genuine threat, or is he just very, very good at running at people?
I think his decision-making is improving, but it's still erratic, and he's always probably going to be that way. But you can't. There's not really anything you can do to stop a threat like that.
All right. Every day is a school day, as you know, and I learnt this weekend that Nuno Espirito Santo was Mourinho's backup goalkeeper back in, you know, the glory years at Porto. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I think he's up against Lampard as well, obviously, in the week. So
nice
back to back.
Old kind of, you know, former players. Yeah, so, yeah, Lamps's derby are at Old Trafford this Tuesday. Wolves, also in the Carabao Cup, they'll be hosting Leicester. Have you seen much derby, Adam?
I haven't really, no.
And Michael, have you seen much derby? No, okay.
I mean, I've never really watched the Championship, but I like the fact Adam just doesn't bother now Wolves are not in there. There's no need.
Right. Wow. Sounds like we all need to listen to the Totally Football League show, because I bet Caroline Barker and co are going to be all over the extraordinary Frank Lampard's derby team. Other League Cup fixtures include Oxford United hosting Man City, and Spurs Watford. Oh, we'll talk about Watford shortly, because you went to their game at Craven Cottage,
yeah,
didn't you,
Rafa? Yeah, I did, yeah.
Yeah, hold off on that, though.
Okay.
We'll do some other bits first.
I can barely, but I will.
All right.
He lines up to hit it, and yes! It's deflected for a corner. That's over 12 corners. Yes! And no time to take it, though. It's finished 0-0. What a result.
Sorry, our fault. You see, with same-game multibets from Paddy Power, you can combine multiple selections from one match into one bet, and you'll get money back as a free bet if one leg of your fourfold same-game multibet lets you down. Paddy Power, enough of the nonsense. Applies to pre-match fourfold same-game multibets on UK and top European leagues. Max free bet £10 per customer per day. Minimum odds. Exclude shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Listener, if you're coming along to Totally Football Live in London tonight, perhaps you were meaning to go to FIFA's The Best but have now decided there's a better option just next door, then you can contribute a question with the hashtag TFSLive. And by the way, even if you're not coming along, you can follow all of the fun by following us on Instagram at The Totally Show on the gram. Show will be kicking off 8 o'clock tonight at Queen Elizabeth Hall. Maybe one or two tickets still available on the door. Do come along if you'd like. Of course, next Friday, we're up in Manchester. That's Rory Smith, Daniel Story and James Horncastle. And See Tickets have details of that, SEE.com. Mentioned the Totally Football League show. And of course, on Tuesday morning, you can also enjoy the Totally Scottish Football show. And boy, they've got a lot to talk about at the moment, given that Celtic lost this weekend. They're off to their worst start in 20 years. They're down in, do you know where they are in the SPL? Adam?
Below Hearts.
Sixth place. Admittedly, Hearts, who are on top, as you know, despite dropping points this weekend, they are 5 points clear, and the next five teams are all within 1 point of each other. But Rangers are currently in second place, then Hibs, then Livingston, then Kilmarnock, who beat Celtic this weekend, and then Brendan Rodgers' team. Wow. Rangers and Celtic, of course, did have positive results in the Europa League. Celtic winning 1-0 at home to Rosenborg. Rangers drawing 2-2 at Villarreal, which is a very decent result. Two away goals there. Anyway, all that sort of thing you can hear about and why Celtic and why Rangers and why Hearts, above all. You can find all that kind of thing out from Andrew Slaven and co. in the Totally Scottish Football Show, which is going to be out sort of late Monday, early Tuesday. On the subject of the Europa League, you'll be heartened to know that Benjamin Kololi is fine. Did you see he's the FC Zurich midfielder who ran off the pitch across the running track and then hurdled a little wall to celebrate with the fans, only to disappear from sight because there wasn't the floor where he thought it was going to be. But apparently he was all right.
That's good news.
Yeah. Now, at this point, we can either talk Premier League, Michael, or we can go continental with such delights as Gervinho running 82 metres to score for Parma. Which do you fancy?
I mean, I'd prefer Premier League, but I feel like I'm being tempted down a different path.
Yes, you are. There's so many delights down that path, including the Bundesliga, Rafa, where, yeah, Bayern Munich are top, etc., and so on. But the side that was the revelation of the German top division last year, Schalke, finishing second from top, are now second from bottom. What's going on?
They're bottom.
Oh, and they're bottom.
Four defeats in a row.
Yikes.
For Domenico Tedesco. He got the 1 point against Porto in the Champions League. That's the only point that that they have. Doesn't count domestically, of course. And they've got a difficult game away to Freiburg on Tuesday night. And he could go 5-5 as far as defeats is concerned, which is something that his predecessor, Markus Weinziel, did. And, of course, he didn't survive that long in the job. I don't think there's any real danger for him, but it's a perfect illustration of a league that is completely unpredictable from Bayern downwards. So you have Schalke in the bottom, you have Leverkusen just outside the relegation places, you have Leipzig in nowhere land, and then you have some strange teams, in inverted commas, like Hertha in second, Werder Bremen in fourth. So I think it explains why, despite its very low standing internationally, which is deserved, I think, because of the poor performances of teams in Europe and of that lack of competitiveness for the title, domestically the fans are just as excited as they've ever been, because you simply don't know. If you're a Werder Bremen fan, your team might be playing for Champions League places or against relegation or both in the same season.
Right.
So it keeps its capacity to throw up really strange seasons all the time.
But particularly this one, by the looks of it. With any particular reason why that would be? Is it, you know, lack of investment or too much investment? Or
I don't know. It's only four games in, so things will still change.
Right.
But I think what is remarkable is that a lot of the so-called big sides have been really disappointing. I mean, even Dortmund, who are okay in terms of results, under Lucien Favre, new manager, people felt that he was going to immediately improve the team. It's taken a lot more time than anticipated. Leipzig, with Ralf Rangnick back in charge, are really struggling to play any sort of decent football. The same can be said of Schalke, of course. And even Stuttgart, who were tipped by many as sort of Europa League contenders, they're also in the relegation zone. So,
wow. Is it because all the good German managers have left for the Premier League?
Some of them have left. Some of them have left for Ligue 1. But
oh, yeah.
I think management is not the issue, but there is certainly a lack of consistency for the bigger sides. And you wonder at what point the Bundesliga will go back to have a kind of a more stable top four, which I think might not be as exciting, but will then have a positive effect as far as European performances are concerned. The Premier League's big dominance in Europe came on the back of, I think, 6 or 7 years where the same teams always qualified for the Champions League. And that kind of experience and money, of course, cannot be easily replaced. If you suddenly have Hoffenheim in the Champions League, you know, for the first time, I think they will probably struggle, despite a decent start, to get out of the group. And then Schalke have the same issue. So it's going to be difficult, I think, for the league to get back to where they were 5 years ago when they had two teams in the final, of course.
Right. And what about Bayern themselves, one of those two teams? Because they had a good result last week, midweek, away at Benfica.
Yeah.
But it raised, I think, a lot of eyebrows how they didn't make a big move in the summer and transfer.
Yeah, it's been a strange one. I think they're keeping their powder dry for the big change when Robin and Ribéry finally do retire at the end of the season, which they might not, because they're playing really well again. At which point, Bayern really, I think, have to invest quite heavily in the team. Right now, something quite unexpected has happened, which is the big improvement has come through the coach. When Niko Kovac came in, a lot of people were hugely underwhelmed. They said, you know, what has he done? Nothing really. Okay, he won the cup with Frankfurt against Bayern. Yes, okay, nice result. But they play the game 100 times. Bayern will win 85, a bit of a fluke. And the players, I think, themselves were a little bit, let's say, apprehensive of this change. But he's won them over, not because he is a guy with a glittering CV, but he has just done little things tactically that have worked. And Joshua Kimmich came out and said, maybe it doesn't really matter so much what you've done in the past, but what you actually do tactically. And I thought it was an interesting thing to say for a player, because he seemed to be saying that we might have had big names in the past, but not all of them have done the work that we, as a team, felt we need to do. And Bayern look a lot sharper. They look a lot more coherent tactically, and you take their quality, which individually and collectively is far above anyone else, and then you add that bit of extra that they seem to have lost since Guardiola left, and basically makes for a combination that makes their lead completely unassailable. Michael Reschke, the sporting director of Stuttgart, said when they played against Bayern the other day, after 1 minute we knew against this Bayern team we have absolutely no chance of getting any result. Because if they play with that kind of motivation, commitment, organisation, then we have no chance.
Rafa, where do you actually rate this Bayern team against some of the other top sides in Europe, especially, you know, when you look at City and Liverpool?
It's the question that everyone's asking themselves, because it's difficult to evaluate their performances. Because
Wolves?
I think they could beat Wolves, yes. But it's difficult to evaluate their performances because they're so superior. So at certain stage, you no longer really know what it is. Is it really because only in relative terms they're so far better, yeah, or are they actually objectively so much better? I think last year, where they had a very easy run and then pushed Real Madrid all the way to the semi-final, would suggest that they are objectively still a pretty decent side. I saw that bookmakers rate them really highly, above some of the bigger sides even, and maybe that's a reflection of, again, another easy draw that they have in the group stage. Mm. But I think they have something this year where they look at the details, and they have in Thiago someone who plays now in a deeper role, who is making a huge difference, because basically teams have stopped pressing them altogether because they know there's just no point. You can't press Thiago. The guy just steps away from you and you have three guys who are out of the game, and it makes them even harder to play against. So I think Liverpool would be the sort of team that Bayern would hate playing against, whereas City, they probably feel that they got a decent chance, because if they keep the ball off City, I think Bayern feel that they could do something. So there is not much between those teams, and the question will once again will be, when it comes to these bigger games
in March
whether Bayern's lack of competitiveness domestically, competitive challenge, is a benefit or is a disadvantage because they're not as sharp, etc. But we will only find out in a few months' time.
Excellent. Hey, Michael, let's take back control. Let's have some proper English football now. We'll get onto that Gervinho thing later on, and all the other exciting details of the Continental weekend, but a pretty special weekend in the Premier League as well, from the great entertainers Burnley, who went and put four goals past Bournemouth. What on earth happened here? Because they'd only scored three previously all season.
Yeah, funny one, a very unexpected result, I think, before the game. And to be honest, once he'd watched the highlights as well, I think Bournemouth had a few good chances. Quite scrappy goals, I think, from Burnley, the kind of goals you expect Burnley to score. I wouldn't be entirely surprised if they rose out of trouble, to be honest.
Burnley?
I think the Europa thing was such a big issue for them. And it was the players were so unaccustomed to that, the demands of European football, that now they've got a free run. They've got one game every weekend. Defensively, they still look pretty good.
Right.
I'm not sure they'll be scoring four goals every week, but they've got...
If Aaron Lennon's in that kind of form.
Yeah, it was good to see him starring, and particularly scoring. I mean, the one thing that Lennon's never been good at over the course of his career is he's never scored enough goals. So it was a good finish at the far post, and then he did some good kind of more traditional Aaron Lennon work down the right for one of the later goals. So, nice to see him firing.
I'm surprised to see that Lennon said he thought the win was coming, because I don't think many people did think it was coming. I think they've been desperately poor. But they brought Vidra in and they brought Loughton back at right back, and it seemed to make a difference.
Excellent. Their four goals eclipsed by the five City put past Cardiff. Gundogan the key to everything, is that right, Raf?
Oh, he certainly was this weekend. He was outstanding. Cardiff, I felt, might actually go for it and try to press City the way that Lyon did, but perhaps they didn't quite trust themselves to do that, and they gave too much space to City. And essentially, if you lay off City, there's only, I think, a question of time before they will unpick you and find an opening. And with goal after goal, you could just see Cardiff's belief just draining, and they just didn't know what to do anymore. But Gundogan was very good. I think the criticism for him has been, or the question mark is, can he play that way under pressure when teams are really up against it and don't give you a lot of time? Is he good enough to be in that role? But certainly when you give him time, he can play as well as anyone as a creator in that deep creation role.
There are five outstanding goals from City in different ways, but I thought the most interesting was the first one, because it started from an Edison throw-out, and it looked set to be a really quick counter-attack, and Cardiff actually got numbers back quite quickly. And I just thought it was really intelligent the way City slowed the game, which is what Guardiola likes. He likes teams to put together passes so that they can get into their kind of correct structure. And they almost waited for Cardiff to recover and then went for them. It was almost like a, you know, like two cyclists dueling where yeah. you know, one guy's just got so much more that he almost lets his opponent recover and then kind of kills him for a second time. And yeah, it just showed
Who scored
the two
that first one, Michael?
It was swept home by Aguero.
Yeah. Okay, that was Aguero. And then the Riyad Mahrez, the first of his brace, there were 20 passes in the build-up, which is the longest move for a goal in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, and yet another one of those City goals where it's just so easy for the finisher because it's squared into almost a six-yard box between the posts. They score so many simple finishes from brilliantly complex moves.
Right. What's the latest on Leroy Sané and his issues with Germany, Raf?
Well, we'll have to see. I'm sure he'll be in the squad again, but the fact that Toni Kroos spoke out so publicly about his lack of application and maybe one or two body language issues should come as a concern for him, because reading between the lines, that was one of the reasons why Löw felt he couldn't quite trust him to go as one of the non-starters to the World Cup. I think there was a concern that he would not take it well, being so confident and perhaps even feeling that he should be in the team. So if one of the senior players feels that he should make the statement publicly, having done so first, I understand, in a dressing room, face-to-face, it is a bit of a warning sign. And it's not the first time, and it won't be the last time, that a young player who does really well at club level comes to the national team and then gets slapped down a little bit by the more experienced pros for...
Okay, so it wasn't that controversial what Kroos said in Germany?
Controversial? No, it was not controversial. I think over here people jumped to conclusions and wrongly felt that this was another incident of a white, blue-eyed, blonde guy criticizing someone who looks a little bit different, but there is no connotations at all about this. Toni Kroos himself was for years criticized for lax body language by other players. Michael Ballack had the same issue, was called arrogant by other players. So this is not about this. This is really about a young player who, at the Confed Cup, felt he didn't want to take part because he had a nose operation. People in the German FA felt that was probably not the right thing for him to do. He should have taken that chance. And this is an issue that's been mentioned before, even going back to his youth days at Schalke, I think, where he was once substituted after 20 minutes because he just didn't do enough on the pitch. So,
Alrighty.
No racial connotations.
Some say it with flowers, some say it with chocolates, and listeners, our friends at Beer 52 want to help us say thank you for listening to the Totally Football Show by giving you a free case of craft beer. All you have to do is head to beer52.com/totally to claim it. Beer 52 is the world's most popular monthly craft beer discovery club. They search out incredible and exclusive small batch craft beers from the world's greatest breweries. Every month they focus on a new country or theme, and this time it's the Balkans, so this is your chance to sample grown-up drinks such as the 7.2% Croatian Citrus IPA, a Slovenian Black IPA, and a delightful 6% New England IPA from the Bulgarian brewery Aleyak. Because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can try your first case for free. You just pay £2.95 postage. So that's 8 incredible craft beers, some bar snacks, and a copy of Ferment magazine, all delivered with next day shipping. There's no minimum commitment with Beer 52. You can just take this free case, try the beers, and see what you think. If it's not for you, you can pause or cancel your subscription at any time. Try it for yourself at beer52.com/totally and claim your free case today. That's beer52.com/totally.
In the Football League, Gary Monk, who, like most people, is a former manager of Leeds, took his Birmingham side to Elland Road and won. First defeat for Leeds under their crazy manager, Marcelo Bielsa. They do stay top, though, after Borough drew with another of Monk's former club, Swansea. How about that? And there was an amazing goal at Villa Park. Did you see that, Adam?
Fantastic.
Yeah. John McGinn.
I love the way it bounced down the crossbar as well, which is essential for any good goal like that.
Was it the goal of the weekend, though? Do you think Jovinho, perhaps?
I'd go for McGinn, but I think you would go for Jovinho.
Well, actually, here's Richard Sexton, who says, was John McGinn's volley on Saturday the greatest of all time? Perhaps, says Richard optimistically, the panel could compile a top five.
Well, I think the problem with McGinn's goal was that he was on the losing side. So I think the goal was great in itself, but it kind of loses something from being essentially irrelevant.
Right.
Whereas Marco van Basten's volley, for example, won the European Championship. So.
Or Totti's against Sampdoria. My favourite would have to be Dejan Stankovic from the halfway line. I don't see anybody beating that. To volley in from the halfway line.
Goalkeeper wasn't in a great position, was he?
I don't care. He volleyed in from the halfway line. That was the most ridiculous goal. Any others you want to contribute?
There's also one I would suggest that listeners seek out on YouTube, which is Jürgen Wegmann's goal of the season, 1988.
How are you spelling that?
W-E-G-M-A-N-N.
Good.
Wegmann. Which is the weirdest, strangest volley because it's sort of a cross between a volley and an overhead kick, but it's an unbelievable goal.
Anyway, may I mention that Villa lost anyway 2-1 and got booed off in Steve Bruce's 100th game in charge. If you like all that kind of thing, as I mentioned, Totally Football League show with Caroline Barker. Spain, 10-man Barcelona got helped by Girona, which means that Real Madrid have pulled level with them, Michael, on top of the Liga. Mm-hmm. They had a 1-0 win. Asensio scoring. He looked this time. Where did you stand on his no-look shenanigans? Not that bothered.
Didn't have a problem with it, but it didn't go in, did it? So I can't understand why people are going on about it.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Alaves in third place and Celta Vigo fourth. Crikey. In Italy, it was a big win for the Inzaghis. The Inzaghi brothers, Pippo Inzaghi. His Bologna team beat Roma 2-0. There's all sorts of talk their manager might get fired. Their opponent next weekend is Pippo's brother Simone Inzaghi's Lazio, who beat Genoa 4-1, so that's going to be a bit tasty. They'll be playing in the Rome derby, of course. Also next weekend, Juve-Napoli. Both those teams won. They're first and second right now, Rafa. Yes, Ronaldo scored again. And I think, interestingly, the Gazette addressed that they were playing away at Frosinone, who were inaugurating their brand new kind of 16,000-capacity stadium. And the Gazette rather... Well, a little bit patronising. Their big headline on Saturday morning was Lilliput and Gulliver. They had kind of, obviously Ronaldo was Gulliver and they regarded Frosinone as very much the Lilliputians of this equation. But the exciting news was that Ronaldo, his celebration, do you remember how he was used to kind of run off on his own and then jump and then ta-da? He's now celebrating with his teammates. And when they score, he's hugging them and things. Will it last? I don't know. But there's all this talk in Italy about how he's been won over by the affection ever since that overhead kick. But I think even with, you know, the aftermath of the expulsion last week. So it's all very much love and kisses there. There was all sorts of excitement at San Siro, but we'll get into that on Golazzo on Wednesday, Michael, because we need to talk about Federico Chiesa embracing his brother. Did you see that?
I did see that.
That was so touching, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Afterwards, the camera zooms in on the... So this is Federico Chiesa.
Son of.
Enrico Chiesa, who famously, when he was at Siena, scored and then ran over because Federico was a ball boy and he hugged him, and etc. The boy's cheeks blushed red as he gazed at his goal-scoring father with filial pride and all this. Anyway, the scene was reenacted to the delight of Enrico and Mrs. Chiesa, who were watching from the stands, after Federico basically ran the length of the field in Gervinho-esque fashion, doing 1-2s and all that kind of thing. He then managed to finish off somebody else's chance and score. I think Fiorentina's third goal at the weekend. He then looks round for his brother, Lorenzo, who was way down the other end. He bombs down the other end of the field, points to him, and then gives him a big hug, and then runs back on to continue with the game. And the camera zooms in on the younger Chiesa, who goes bright red, poor chap. You know when your family hug you. It's awful. Anyway, and Gervinho did that 82-metre coast-to-coast. And excitingly, his shot, I think, went off two posts as well. So that made it even more special. Do you want to talk about Grant Holt joining wrestling?
Did anyone watch
it? Nobody watched it. Only wrestling fans watched it. And who would be a wrestling fan? Anyway,
when I was young, to be fair.
Were you? Yeah. Some people still are. Producer Ben's a very big wrestling fan. He does a wrestling podcast called Parts Unknown. Adam, I'm guessing you're not a wrestling fan.
I was, but I grew out of
Shawn
it. I don't
Michaels,
know how.
Michaels, Diesel, Undertaker, yeah, Razor Ramon.
Bit, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, Grant Holt is very much a wrestling fan. And to everyone's surprise, in a 40-man Royal Rumble in Norwich, which I'm not familiar with the rules of these things, but I think you start off with 40 people in the ring and you get knocked out one by one. The last man standing was Grant Holt, who was dressed in civvies. He'd kind of come on as a surprise in an entirely unplanned and spontaneous development at this Norfolk-based Royal Rumble. So there you go. Well, you can watch the video if you like. It's quite physical. I quite enjoyed it.
So hold on.
Yeah.
You don't enjoy being hugged by family members.
I didn't say I didn't. Just
yeah,
when you're 14 and, you know, there are TV
but
cameras.
You do enjoy it when random men...
Oh, I like seeing other men hugging.
...grapple different body parts. And,
There's nothing contradictory about that at all, Rafa. You and your subtext.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
OK, more Premier League. How about Arsenal-Everton?
Yeah, that was one of those games, if you only look at the scoreline, you can be led very much astray.
Why?
Everton were the better side in the first half, most definitely in the opening exchanges. Cech did really well to keep them from giving Arsenal, I think, just a real hiding in that opening period, because it was quite incessant. Everton were clever enough to know that if they pressed high against Arsenal, they'd have joy, because they are so devoted to building from the back, even if it's not a good idea. And, you know, while I think it's very good that Emery's trying to infuse his playing style there, I think there still has to be intelligence when you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Lacazette with a phenomenal goal. That sort of changed the momentum of the match a little bit. And then, you know, a Aubameyang not being flagged offside was absolutely ridiculous. A shocking decision, which Silva pointed out afterwards. I thought Everton were stronger in the duels, just especially in the first half, looked more off a complete side in what they did on the ball and off it. And I just think Arsenal's transition is not going as well as perhaps the results have shown. I think they've been fortunate in a sense.
But if we have to cut Chelsea some slack, I mean, Emery's got a more difficult job now in trying to... They've always been good going forward, but in terms of making them solid defensively, they kept a clean sheet here, Raf.
They did, although they have, as Melissa said, they had really Peter Cech to thank for that. They were all over the place defensively in the first half. They were so susceptible to counter-attacks. You have this problem when you play with Mesut Ozil and Ramsey that the midfield has a tendency of getting overrun. Now, in Torreira, they have now a guy who's like a orthodox holding midfielder. I think that protects the back four, but you still then have the issue with the fullbacks being a little bit exposed because Aubameyang on the flank doesn't really come back either. So there are still issues. I don't think Emery has the harder job in the sense that he needs to transform the team's playing style. It's still an Arsenal team playing Arsenal football. He just needs to work on some of the defensive transitions, some of the details, making them more compact. But I think the change isn't that drastic. Than going from Conte to Sarri, to a complete possession style. And there are some encouraging signs about this Arsenal team, but at the same time, you feel that there are still some real issues. And I wonder if that, for me, the bigger issue, which isn't so much tactical, but the mindset of that comfort zone that the whole club has been in for so many years, whether Emery is the right guy to really shake them up and say, unless you perform all the time, unless you play with total commitment and don't accept anything but a win, whether he is that guy that can really galvanize this team to that extent, that is my big question mark. I'm still not convinced.
Are you seeing progress, Michael? And also, how much trouble is Marco Silva in?
I don't think Silva's in much trouble. I thought Everton played well and were quite fortunate. Yeah, it's a funny one with Emery. I mean, like Melissa says, the results have been good, but the performances have just been slightly unconvincing. I thought the major problem yesterday was without the ball in every aspect of the play, whether it was pressing high, they got bypassed. I know Torreira and Xhaka are both tacklers, but I think there's a question about the lack of discipline. Torreira got a silly early booking, which he did a lot in Serie A. And there was one crazy defensive incident where Mustafi made quite a good interception and then immediately conceded the ball. And Sokratis, in his desperation to cover the mistake, brought down Walcott, I think, on the edge of the box in such a clumsy fashion he had to go off injured when Mustafi had already been limping from going down awkwardly himself. And they're just both quite clumsy. And going forward, I'm just not sure I'm not sure Emery has really any closer to finding his preferred combination. I mean, you look at the side yesterday, Aubameyang's their best striker and was playing on the left. Ozil was the best number 10 and was playing on the right. They weren't combining. And Emery slightly sheepishly admitted after the game in the press conference that just before Lacazette's brilliant goal, he was planning to bring him off, which I think is a sign that it really wasn't working going forward. So they're kind of grinding out wins, but I think this was probably their least impressive performance so far, to be honest.
All right, okay.
And I think also it brought into sharp relief Everton's lack of a real goal scorer up front. I think if there'd been anyone in the habit of goal scoring, they would have taken one or two of those chances. But Sigurdsson was almost playing as a false nine at times. Calvert-Lewin holds the ball up well, but doesn't really exude much of a threat, I think, with the ball. And Richarlison is this really powerful winger who gets into good positions, but you don't really trust him to necessarily make the right decision all the time.
Because Theo Walcott always wanted to play as a centre forward, so there's that.
I think he would have been disappointed not to play up front yesterday, actually. Mm. You know, considering Arsenal's defence's lack of pace, he did get through in that just before half time when Cech made a save. But yeah, I think he would be disappointed not to start up front.
Right. Elsewhere, Brighton lost at home to Spurs. Spurs fans singing, "There's only one Chas Hodges. Chas Hodges is one of our own." And Spurs are on their way to Wembley in honour of the man who penned that famous ode,
ditty.
Let's go with ditty.
I think Brighton played one of their numbers at half time as well.
Oh, did they?
Which is nice. Brighton are quite good for that. They're quite a... Away fans like going to Brighton. They're a welcoming, accommodating club, I think.
Wow, and the Spurs were quite happy going home as well with their 3 points. Did they deserve them?
That was a big result for Tottenham, I think. That would have been four defeats in a row. And they've got Huddersfield and Cardiff coming up now, so it sort of changes the mood around the place.
Right.
It feels like they're over that little bit of a potential crisis if they had lost.
Although
I think it's good to see Lamella score as well, but back-to-back weekends, so that's important for Tottenham. They look now like, not so much as Liverpool, it's all been said that they don't have the strength in depth, but you look at Moura now, you look at Son coming back, Lamella, they do have some options there.
Spurs midweek have Watford in the cup, so that's at Wembley, is it, Michael?
No, Wembley's not available, and White Hart Lane obviously isn't ready, so they're playing in Milton Keynes, which personally I think is very odd decision, odd situation. I mean, that's not what a home game is. I think if you can't put on a home game at your regular home stadium or your temporary home stadium, then you should just switch the tie. I mean, playing in Milton Keynes isn't... It's a slightly separate issue, but if you're picking and choosing where you're playing your home games, I think that sets a slightly dangerous precedent in terms of teams sacrificing home games to play it wherever they want. I think it's bizarre. Should be at Vicarage Road.
Okay. You saw Watford this weekend, Rafa.
I did,
You went along to your favourite Premier League ground.
Yeah, I think it's everyone's favourite Premier League ground, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's Craven very
Cottage.
Nice. Craven Cottage, yeah. But what do you think, Adam? Where's
it's
your favourite
so
ground? It doesn't have to be Premier League, actually. It could be anywhere.
No, I enjoy Fulham. Yeah, it's good to have them back. I used to live in Putney, and it's
there
a great walk to the ground as well.
Isn't it, though? Melissa?
I like going to Selhurst Park. It's weird, because it's not the biggest. The facilities are really bad, especially if you're there to cover the game. You're always getting impeded views. But it's so close to the ground, and the fans really, if they're up for it, and if they get any sort of encouragement from their side, it feels like a proper football game at a proper old-school football ground.
Okay. Michael, do you have a preference?
I'm a big fan of St James's Park.
Right.
I think there's just something about the atmosphere there. Whether it's good or bad, either way, it's quite unique, I think.
Feels like you're at an event.
So back to Watford Fulham.
Anyway, but on Saturday you went to Craven Cottage and you saw Fulham and Watford draw 1-1. Anything we should know about this game?
Yeah, I think there were lots of interesting things happening in this game. First of all, it was the proverbial game of two halves, because Watford were all over Fulham and should have really been out of sight by the end of the first half. They were so superior, they pressed Fulham. Fulham very much, dare I say, looked like a championship team for large spells, completely unable to keep the ball in midfield. Overrun. Schürrle, Vieto and Mitrovic had absolutely no ball. The ball was just coming straight back. And then the second half, things really changed. He took off McDonald, Jukanovic, and that made a big difference, because he was just not able to play, I think, in that position. Certainly not against half-decent opposition. And they went from a three in midfield to a two, but actually had more control, because they had much better players, well, at least one much better player in that position.
Who came on for McDonald then?
Akita Pek came on.
Uh-huh.
And he moved up a little bit. And then Sarri had just more of the ball. And in effect, the fact there was only two of them, and Johansson is not a great player either, but the fact there was only two and four players up front just made it harder for for Watford to cut down these passes, and they just went a little bit more direct, but more effectively because they had one more player to pass the ball to. And Fulham and Mitrovic and Schürrle, and to an extent Vieto, who's a little bit raw and a little bit sort of inconsistent in his movement, his decisions, have enough, I think, to get the odd result. But overall, you wonder whether especially that defence and that midfield will be able to stay up. I fear for them a little bit. And Watford, I think, conversely, you have to say that they are in that position because they have a really, really strong side.
And a settled one too. Like Wolves, they've named the same lineup in all six league games so far.
Yeah.
Even though Troy Deeney says he's playing with three broken toes. I mean, I've mentioned it before, but I've been with a broken toe twice. So, you know, hats off to Troy Deeney.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Watford kind of threw it away a little bit. And when they stopped pressing, or perhaps they found it much harder to press once McDonald was off, they just looked a little bit sloppy themselves. So it was interesting, really entertaining game. And I think two sides that, well, certainly one side in Watford that are definitely worth the hype. In a sense.
Okay.
Yeah. I was looking at some of the numbers from Fulham, and they've conceded the most shots on target, most big chances, most errors leading to shots. And I'm kind of surprised how sloppy they've been, because they did finish the season really well in the Championship, but they just, it does look far too open.
Intrepid supporters who made it all the way to Selhurst Park in far-flung south-east London were entertained by a 0-0 draw with Newcastle. Crystal Palace have now failed to find the net at home in any of their three fixtures there this campaign, even though Zaha was playing this time. That's not good.
Yeah, Hodgson was a little bit frustrated, it seems, with so much media fuss around Zaha and his complaints about the challenge last week.
Well, he made them.
Well, I think that was his point. He was annoyed at Zaha.
Oh, I see.
Making a thing about it. And the speculation afterwards. Again, Palace created enough chances to win the game. It was Sacco this time who pretty much missed an open goal header. And they just dropped too many points because they missed chances. No, we blame Benteke a lot, but there's been some culprits this season. I remember they lost to Watford narrowly because Joel Ward missed pretty much a, you know, 2-yard chance in the last minute. Sacco here, they're just so frustrating to watch because, you know, they're gradually proving Jules right, which I think is the worst thing of all.
Wow. Well, a long way to go, of course. Also down in the danger zone, Huddersfield, who took the lead away at Leicester, but ended up losing 3-1. Is David Wagner being found out, Rafa?
No, I think that's an incredibly harsh thing to say. Found out means that there was this great mystery about how Huddersfield are playing, and now people have cracked the code, but there was... Everyone could see what they're doing. It's based on organisation, on energy, on pressing. And when it works, it can be very effective. But when only one run is wrong, or you don't win the ball in the area that you're trying to, then you're hugely open. And of course, individually, you're outmatched from the get-go before ball is kicked. And I think it was always an attempt to defy gravity. Mm. The fact that it worked out last year is huge credit to the team and to Wagner. The fact that it might not work out for a second year, I think, is to be expected, unfortunately. There's only so much you can do with these players.
I see. Claude Puel, in the meantime, with at his disposal, a team which involves one of the brightest prospects in the Premier League in James Maddison, would you say, Adam?
Yeah, definitely. I think he's a really interesting player, and he's playing further forward under Puel. I really like the way he can receive the ball, he's back to goal, and just turn. It's almost like Eden Hazard, the way he sort of turns away to his right.
Mm.
Interesting player, and I think surprising with Puel. He always seems to be, I think even now he's top of the list for the sack race, and people think he's going to go, but they're ninth in the league. I'm not sure what more he could be doing in terms of results. 3 wins from 6.
I think that probably covers everything that we need to cover. Unless
there was a couple of interesting results from maybe more minor European leagues.
Go on.
PSV beat Ajax 3-0.
Did they?
Obviously, a big fixture at the top of the Eredivisie. Mm. PSV now managed by Marc van Bommel.
Indeed.
And in Switzerland, Young Boys thrashed Basel 7-1, which again is a meeting between the top two. Basel had won the league 8 years in a row. Young Boys won it last year.
And coming into this weekend, they were already 8 points clear at the top of the ever-competitive Swiss Super League.
Yeah, and this game was also unusual because the 7 goals were scored by 7 different players, which you don't see very often.
You don't, do you? I wonder what their margin is at the top right now. We can update that on Thursday, in Thursday's Totally Football Show. Before we wrap up this one, let's get the odds on some of the many matches we've been discussing today. Over to producer Ben, who's been speaking to Paddy Power.
Thank you, Jimbo. I've got Lee Price from Paddy Power on the line, as always. And Lee, let's talk about the League Cup, because there are a couple of juicy ties coming up. Let's talk about Liverpool taking on Chelsea. Can I get the first goal scorer market on this one, please?
You can indeed. And it looks like it'll be a sea of red here from our betting. All the top bets are Liverpool players. Salah's the favourite at 7-2, followed by Sturridge, Mane, Firmino. It's only then you get down to Chelsea star Hazard at 11-2, the same price as Shaqiri.
Elsewhere, it's Man U versus Derby. Man U have real trouble with promoted sides. Derby aren't promoted yet. They may not be promoted at all. But, you know, what's going to go on here when Lampard goes up against his old mentor, Mourinho?
Well, Paul Pogba wants them to attack, attack, attack. And we think they might do just that. They're 1-6 to beat Derby at home. The draw's 11-2 and the visitors are massive 12-1. But I'm always reluctant to talk up United at the minute.
Back to the Premier League, and Burnley had perhaps the best result of the weekend, 4-0 versus Bournemouth. Can they make it back into the top half and sort of be Burnley again?
Well, I don't think anyone foresaw their victory on the weekend. That massive thump in Bournemouth dramatically improving their odds for us. But they're still third favourites for the drop, ahead of the likes of Newcastle even, and behind only Huddersfield and Cardiff. But they're now 8-1 to finish in the top half again. That's come in massively. Maybe they're back on song.
And a result which we've kind of glossed over in the show. Arsenal, pretty impressive against very weak opposition in the Europa League. What are their odds looking like for winning that tournament?
Well, at this stage of the season, Arsenal are second favourites to win the Europa League, which might sound slightly mad. They're 6-1, behind only Chelsea at 4-1. That puts Arsenal above the likes of Unai Emery's former team, Sevilla, in the betting, who, at 13-1, might be more tempted for some punters.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. 10 points now. The margin for young boys at the top of the Swiss League, which may or may not be called the Super League, Adam. I don't know. Apologies, Swiss listener. Anyway, Melissa, thanks for coming down. Is there anything you want to plug in terms of your other appearances, you know?
I've got a big interview coming up with Jurgen Klopp that documents his 3 years in charge of Liverpool.
Which, have you already done the interview?
No, It will happen this week and it will go out on the 8th of October and throughout the rest of that week. Obviously, the 8th of October 2015 is when he signed his contract to become Reds manager.
Excellent. He's a lot of fun to talk to, isn't he, Rafa?
He is, yes.
Yeah. Good. Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. Adam, thanks ever so much for coming in.
No problem.
Raphael, a delight to see you.
Thank you, James.
When are you next back?
I think in a couple of weeks' time.
And you're going to be on the Goal Show next time that Who's interview.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's good. And Michael Cox, splendid stuff as ever.
Thank you.
Well done, you listener. We'll catch up with you Thursday. Have a great time till then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And make sure you check out our other football podcasts, the revamped Totally Football League Show with Caroline Barker and the brand new Totally Scottish Football Show. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really. And here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK. So that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5 p.m. till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.